Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the murder of the prominent Russian opposition politician Boris Nemtsov close by the Kremlin in a brazen act of intimidation on the eve of an opposition rally that Nemtsov had called for, where he planned to denounce Russia's war on Ukraine and expose the role of Russian forces in the war. Russian journalist and author Masha Gessen, the author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, joins us to discuss her article at the New York Times, Russia's Army of Avengers, and the demonstrations in Russia mourning the death of Nemtsov and the intimidation of the few political opponents left in Putin's Russia. Then we will speak with Mark Ames, the founding editor of the satirical Moscow biweekly The Exile, who is now a senior editor at Pando Daily. He was kicked out of Putin's Russia, but remains in contact with the country now under the tightening grip of a criminal regime with a history of killing off critics of the Kremlin, often in flagrant ways meant to intimidate. We will try to assess the Kremlin's involvement in this assassination and the lawless and ultranationalist forces unleashed by the regime's propaganda machine and the war in Ukraine Putin is pursuing. Then finally, we will get an analysis of why gas prices are going up and the failure of the mainstream press to look into the real culprit, which are the big banks on Wall Street speculating in oil futures, which the Congress recently allowed them to do, overturning a provision in the Dodd-Frank Act that kept them out of speculating at the expense of the American consumer. Dyson Slocum, the director of the energy program at Public Citizen, joins us to explain how the big banks bought the politicians who rewarded Wall Street, enabling them to make money for nothing as they gouge us at the pump while hurting the economy. And joining us now is Masha Gessen, who has served as editor of the Russian language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Russia's Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with the cranes. Her books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, Words Will Break Cement, The Passions of Pussy Riot, and she's currently working on a new book about the Sinarov brothers. She has an op-ed at the New York Times, Russia's Army of Avengers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Masha Gessen.
Hi, good to be here.
And Masha, so I take it, and based upon your op-ed at the New York Times, you don't think that this is a hit that that Putin ordered, but rather a result of the forces that he's unleashed.
Yes, and the reason I don't think that, the reason I think that rather is that. You know, it's true that the Kremlin didn't really have to fear Boris Nemtsov. I mean, the Kremlin at this point doesn't really have to fear any opposition politicians at all. It has established a very effective authoritarian regime. It has completely destroyed the electoral system and any sort of system of feedback between society and the government. And Nemtsov was in many ways a marginalized politician, even though he was a former member of the cabinet. At the same time, he was like a red flag for this sort of army of thugs that the government has been created, the movement that is supposed to oppose Ukraine and prevent a repeat of the Ukrainian revolution in Russia. And this is called the Anti-Maidan movement. Last weekend, the Anti-Maidan movement marched in Moscow very much with the Kremlin's approval and apparently funding. They carried a huge banner that said, annihilate the fifth column. And at least one of them, and I think more, carried a portrait of Nemtsov with the words, this is an organizer of the Maidan. To them, he was a real irritant and a real enemy. Now, that said, I mean, first of all, this is a movement empowered by the Kremlin. And sort of, you know, given these vague orders from the Kremlin to defend the motherland and given the go-ahead to engage in violence. That said, we have to look at where this crime happened, right? This was on a bridge right in front of the Kremlin. This bridge is so heavily patrolled, so heavily surveyed. There was one time about a year and a half ago when I was there with a large group of bicyclists. About 20 of us rode under the bridge. And as we approached the bridge, 15 presidential guard ran to us to see what this irregular occurrence was. These bicyclists, you know, in a large group, they're that vigilant around there near the Kremlin, that paranoid. And we see this, shooting in a well-lit place in plain view of the Kremlin. And from the videotapes that have since emerged, the body was on the bridge for 10 minutes without anybody even approaching. The presidential guard very pointedly did not go to see what happened there. They waited for a regular police car to arrive.
Well, and of course, there was a witness that was Nemtsov's girlfriend, who's a Ukrainian, who wants to return to Ukraine as being held. So again, that plays into the narrative. Now, how much in terms of what the Russian press is saying and what the Kremlin is now saying, they're trying to suggest that this was an act by Chechen or Islamic terrorists. They're also bringing up the usual canard, which is the CIA did this as a provocation. But was Nemtsov going to denounce Russia's role in the war and the extent to which Russian military have been involved, which is something that, of course, goes against Putin's propaganda?
Nemtsov had been very consistent in his support for Ukraine and his opposition to the war in Ukraine. In that sense, he really stood out in opposition. Not everybody in opposition was quite as sort of plain-spoken and quite as consistent as Nemtsov was. For example, Alexei Navalny, the anti-corruption blogger, is much more sort of wishy-washy on the annexation of Crimea. Nemtsov was very, very clear. So, again, in that sense, he was an irritant. He wasn't a threat to policy. I mean, there's nothing anybody, any individual or even group of individuals can do at this point in Russia to change policy. But, you know, the country is swept up in this kind of fervor. It is very much a country at war, and I think this is something that we fail to appreciate. It's very difficult to imagine unless you're there, just the amount of propaganda, the amount of war rhetoric, and the amount of the percentage of that war rhetoric that focuses on the enemy within. And in many ways, Nemtsov personified the enemy within.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Masha Gessen, who served as editor of the Russian language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Russia's Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with the cranes. Her books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, and she's currently working on a new book about the Sonara brothers, and she has an op-ed at the New York Times, Russia's Army of Avengers. But there is, obviously, on a certain level, it doesn't make sense that Putin would do something so brazen. But on the other hand, he has done some things that are pretty brazen, or at least they appear to be pretty brazen, not the least of which is blowing up a whole bunch of apartment buildings in order to get himself in power in the first place and prosecute a war. And there's a similar...
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I mean, we don't even have to think that far back. I think the sort of the MO of this crime is very similar to the war in Ukraine. You know, Putin keeps saying it's not the Russian army that's fighting in Ukraine. Putin is sort of the look, ma, no hands approach to committing crimes is very much Putin's signature at this point. You know, he's and armed.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
But doesn't he, you know, I don't, in the case of Anna Politkovskaya, you know, she was killed on his birthday. You don't know whether these are tributes to the Don or this is the Don basically signaling, as he did, I think, using polonium, which is clearly not something you can get off the shelf, in the case of Litvinenko and Yuri Shekhachikhin.
Right.
Yes.
Shekhachikhin, yes.
Yeah. So it seems to me that he wants it both ways.
I don't see a contradiction there. I think it's very much the same pattern. Putin creates a situation in which people get killed. He points to the people who should be getting killed. The people who kill these people go unpunished. And so it's open season, and it's been open season for a long time. This is a new sort of landmark in this open season. And you're absolutely right to list these people like Politkovskaya, like Yuri Shekhachikhin, two opposition journalists who are very much investigative journalists who are exposing things about Putin. Nemtsov was of a different mold, and I think that's part of the reason it's really struck Russians so painfully this time. On the one hand, he was an opponent. On the other hand, he came from the establishment. He was sort of a very integral part of the landscape. Nobody could really imagine that he would get killed. there wasn't a general sense that he was constantly putting his life in danger, as there had been, for example, with Politkovskaya. I'm splitting hairs a little bit right now, and I don't want anybody to think that I'm saying that, you know, Politkovskaya deserved to be killed or was asking for it, but I'm just saying this is, for a lot of Russians, it's really hit home because he seemed so sort of, you know, part of the fabric of Russian politics for a quarter century.
Well, Michael McFaul, the former U.S. ambassador, met with Nemtsov quite often, and he was just saying on television yesterday that every time he met with Nemtsov, the FSB, the former KGB people would be following him and would be there staking him out. So this sort of ties into what you were saying earlier about the bridge, where it's right next to the Kremlin. It's hard not to imagine that this wasn't seen by these same shadowy forces. Even if he's not a threat, they seem to have a lot of people under surveillance. So it's hard not to believe that at least there's some official involvement, whether it's whether the Don didn't give them the nod or not.
Right. I think first of all, you're absolutely right. They had Nemtsov under constant open surveillance, like they have had a lot of people in the opposition under constant open surveillance. And I have a fair amount of personal experience with this. But also, I want to stress again, that bridge, just that physical location, is under constant surveillance. I'll give you another example. You know, if you have a camera with a zoom lens and you train it on the Kremlin from the bridge, you will immediately be apprehended. I mean, they're constantly keeping an eye on that bridge. And so, again, I think it's we're looking at a situation where it was not necessarily the Kremlin's initiative, but it was done in plain view of the Kremlin. The name of the Kremlin is done very cinematically, sort of against the background of the Kremlin. The backdrop is very beautiful. It's, you know, the red stars, and the cathedral of St. Basil is right there. That is a very pointed message. It's a visual message, and it's a textual message. And the textual message is, you know, people will be in the name of the Kremlin and plain view of the Kremlin with impunity.
But who do you think thought that up? I mean, it doesn't seem to me to be the act of some, you know, ultra-nationalist on a kind of drunken rampage.
No, I don't think it's a drunken rampage. I don't think it's a spur-of-the-moment kind of thing. I also don't think it necessarily took a lot of planning. It's part of the aesthetic of this whole pro-Kremlin movement. And again, Nemtsov is a kind of an obvious target for that movement, because he was an Aryan, because he was Jewish, because he was the lead organizer of the anti-war march and the opposition march that was supposed to happen today. The march was canceled in the end, and there was a vigil in Nemtsov's memory instead. And fortunately, it seems that it proceeded peacefully, thank God. There were tens of thousands of people, both in Moscow and in St. Petersburg, participating in the vigil. But, you know, the sort of over-the-top aesthetic is very characteristic of them. They like to wear Cossack uniforms. They like to engage in all sorts of weird dances with fire. I mean, these people are cinematic in these really sinister ways. So again, it all sort of fits into this pattern. And they have a real hatred of outspoken people, of opposition politicians, and of Jews.
So is this a part of this sort of trope that Putin may be, you know, a gangster in charge of a criminal state, but there are worse people waiting in the wings? I mean, if the opposition has all but been intimidated and Navalny's in jail, and now an opposition figure who didn't really have a lot of following has just been murdered so brazenly, is that, at this point, being a member of the opposition yourself and somebody that's exposed yourself to great risk, what's the future of the opposition?
Oh, it's open season in opposition in an even greater way than it was, you know, a week ago. And already a fair number of people who were journalists or activists in Russia a year or two ago are living in exile. And then last year was probably the greatest year for exiles from Russia. to serve the intellectual elite, abandon the country or a large part of it. So I think that will continue. People will have to leave to stay safe. I think increasingly people will have to leave the country in order to be at all effective, because to speak openly and be somewhat secure, you will have to be out of the country. And this is very reminiscent of what was happening in the 1970s and early 80s, when dissidents were constantly forced out of the country because they were faced with the choice of spending years in jail or leaving the country. They would choose to leave the country, in part because that was more effective. Now the choice is even more stark. You know, do you want to be at the to risk dying every day, or do you want to leave the country and be effective? And, you know, someone like Garry Kasparov has already made that choice. Mikhail Khodorkovsky is in exile. A number of outstanding Russian economists are in exile. The leading news publication, Meduza, is functioning from outside of Russia. The editing offices are in Riga because that's the only place where they can stay safe. So that's, I think, that tendency is already established and will be exacerbated. So people will be leaving the country. And if for the rest of the opposition, the people who stay there, they're great peril. And, they need our support. They need us to be paying attention to them. I'm not sure how much we can actually help them from here, because we can't keep them safe, not even by keeping the eyes of the world on it. That's what's really changed in the last year or so, is that Putin has completely stopped caring about what the rest of the world thinks of him.
Well, just in closing, in the last couple of minutes then, Masha Gessen, what is the world to do? If you have this new geopolitical phenomenon of a combination of organized crimes and national security, the mafia and nuclear weapons. We've never been faced with that before. It's one thing to recognize the danger of Putin and recognize what he's doing in terms of prosecuting a war in order to maintain power at home and distract people from the kleptocracy that he's created. But on the other hand, because of the nuclear weapons, which he constantly reminds us of, we have to deal with this guy. How do you do it?
Well, I think we have to admit something that is very difficult for politicians to admit. In fact, it's never been a part of our political conversation, and that is the fact that it's impossible to stop him. The question that is usually asked is, you know, what can we do to stop him? What can we do to deter him? How can we influence him? Let's face it, this guy really does not care anymore what the world thinks of him. He doesn't even care about the economic sanctions that have been imposed on Russia. There's no such thing as an anti-Putin deterrent. There's no such thing as an anti-Putin strategy. That, in one sense, makes the situation quite literally impossible. On the other hand, it also creates a simpler situation for politicians, because really the question we're faced with is, what's the right thing to do? If you know you can't influence this man, if you know you can't either make peace with him or deter him, then think about the right thing to do. You know, and I think that puts a lot of things into a completely different perspective, like the question of whether to arm Ukraine or not is thrown in a different perspective if you realize that there's no such thing as deterrence and there's no such thing as sort of pacifying him.
Well, Masha Gessen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Masha Gessen, who has served as the editor of the Russian language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Russia's Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with the cranes. Her books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, and she's currently working on a new book about the Sanarov brothers. She has an op-ed at the New York Times, Russia's Army of Avengers. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking with the founding editor of the satirical Moscow biweekly, The Exile.
Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Ames, the founding editor of the satirical Moscow biweekly, The Exile. He's now a senior editor at Pando Daily and the author of Going Postal, Rage, Murder, and Rebellion from Reagan's Workplaces to Clinton's Columbine. And he's the co-author of The Exile, Sex, Drugs, and Libel in the New Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Ames.
Thanks for having me on.
And, Mark, there are obviously fairly substantial demonstrations throughout Russia, particularly in Moscow and St. Petersburg, over the murder of Boris Nemtsov, an opposition leader who really didn't have a huge profile, but nevertheless was murdered within sight of the Kremlin. His Ukrainian girlfriend was with him at the time. Apparently she's being held. She wants to go back to Ukraine. I believe that he was going to, at the rally that he had planned on Sunday, he was going to denounce Russia's military involvement in the war in Ukraine and had been warned against doing so. So is this a Kremlin hit?
Honestly, I can't imagine it would be. It would be very odd for Putin to think that his interests would be best met if he killed a fairly obscure former ally, by the way, and now not very popular opposition leader right next to the Kremlin. I mean, these things are destabilizing, in a country where Putin presents himself as, you know, as an all-powerful genius and so on. So it shows, I mean, I think it shows instability in the regime in power, and it shows insecurity too. I mean, certainly if he did have him whacked like that, it would show how deeply and, you know, psychotically insecure he is. But that said, I mean, it's a strange paradox, because in general, you can't order a hit on somebody like Boris Nemtsov right next to the Kremlin, certainly if their security services were involved, without Putin's approval. It was clearly a pretty professionally done hit. I mean, they obviously had staked him out. They knew where his apartment was, where he was walking, and so on and so forth. You can't officially or even semi-officially really do a hit like that without Putin approving it. But I can't imagine under any circumstance, unless Putin has completely lost his mind, why he would approve it and why he would see that as in his interest. He's a political animal. It would make no sense politically. But he's unleashed a lot of forces, and the war has unleashed a lot of forces that I could imagine would try and do something like this.
Well, I recently spoke with Dr. Pavel Felgenhau with the Novaya Gazeta, which is one of the few papers that Putin or his cronies don't control. And he recently said that Putin honestly believes that the CIA is out to kill him. And so maybe there is an element of him, his paranoia, because when you do have absolute control and you're the head of you're the sort of mafia boss of a criminal state, you know that you're not going to leave that the Kremlin, with a golden parachute. You might well leave it on a gurney.
Oh, yeah. Well, I agree with that. That's why he's never given up. That's why he never gave up power. But still, I don't see why this would serve his interests. I mean, there's still a logic to everything he's been doing. He is increasingly paranoid and about the CIA, plots and so on. And that's actually a very typical Russian thing, of Russian people in power. I mean, the conspiratorial mindset. But he being a spook, you know, is going to be that way times 10 anyway. Again, the question is, why wouldn't they have just killed Navalny? Navalny is an actual political threat. He has an actual large political base. And what they're doing is pinning him down every which way through administrative means, which is the usual way.
Right. And he's now in jail.
Or if you're going to put a hit on Nemtsov, you would want to at least try and arrange a car accident or something. It doesn't strike me as the kind of thing he'd do. And you know, these guys have a lot of enemies that go back to the 90s, political enemies. I mean, his partner in liberal crime, Anatoly Chubais, you know, he was, he he was almost a victim of a hit. This was 10 or 15 years. I can't remember exactly when, but they tried to ambush his car with bombs and guns. He got away. Chubais, who's, you know, more powerful than Nemtsov, but they were essentially teammates as liberal reformers. And they caught the perpetrators eventually, and they were essentially ultra-nationalists, angry, pissed off ultra-nationalists, you know, faction within the military intelligence world. You know, Putin presents himself one way through the Kremlin Wizard of Ozery, but he's not. He doesn't control everything in that country. It's still a fairly chaotic country. But he certainly deserves, you know, if he's going to take responsibility as the Vojvoda, as this great leader who controls everything, then this is his responsibility. He's responsible for the atmosphere there.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Ames, who's the founding editor of the satirical Moscow biweekly, The Exile, and now a senior editor at Pando Daily. He's the author of Going Postal, Rage, Murder, and Rebellion from Reagan's Workplace to Clinton's Columbine, and is the co-author of The Exile, Sex, Drugs, and Libel in the New Russia. And as you mentioned, Navalny, who came up with the description of Putin and his rubber stamp political party, United Russia, as the party of thieves and swindlers, and they've got him in jail at the moment. But there is, and of course the Kremlin now are basically spinning it, saying that this is a provocation by either Islamic terrorists or the good old CIA. But if you look at some of the deaths of the liberal politician back in 2003, Sergei Shenkov, and then in July of 2003, Yuri
Shekachikhin, yeah.
Right.
He was exposing the three whales.
Right.
And
And then the Forbes magazine editor, Paul Klebnikov, and then October 2006, Anna Politkovskaya, who was shot dead on Putin's birthday. And then you got Alexander Litvinenko in London, killed with rare radioactive polonium. And then, of course, Boris Berezovsky, who the Kremlin had been trying to get for a long time, finally ends up dead in his home under mysterious circumstances. It seems to me, particularly in the case of Anna Politkovskaya and Litvinenko, that these were kind of mafia-like hits where the mafia was trying to send the signal that we killed you and to intimidate others who cross the Kapo or cross the Don. So doesn't Putin want it both ways quite often? On the one hand, he wants to signal that you don't cross me. If you do, you're dead. And at the same time, you know, go public and profess innocence and outrage.
Yes and no. And I think the other way of wanting it both ways also is that he's this infallible great leader and genius who actually doesn't have a complete handle on and sees certain benefits of allowing a certain amount of violent chaos in his country because it serves his political interests. So, I mean, going back again through some of the killings you mentioned, I mean, Paul Klebnikov of Forbes, for example, was very pro-Putin. He's a white Russian, emigre nationalist. I knew Paul from the mid 90s when he was like violently anti-liberal, the oligarchs and Berezovsky and Yeltsin and all these people. And he was a supporter of Putin and they never found his killers. Politkovskaya, I think the best theory, the most persuasive theories I've heard about her killing is it wouldn't have been Putin. Again, it seems to me bizarre, but it very likely could have been the Chechen thugs who Putin put in power to keep a lid on Chechnya. So ultimately, you know, Putin is responsible for that. Shekachikhin, who was a great, I really admired that guy. He was probably one of the first killed by that polonium radiation, it's thought, that wound up killing Litvinenko. He'd stuck his nose into too many things, that pissed off the FSB, the successor to the KGB. But let's not forget, a lot of this happened under Yeltsin, and I don't say this at all to vindicate, Putin. I think actually, there's sort of two factions out here one that sort of wants to say everything Putin does is evil, but you know, in marked huge contrast to Yeltsin, who was this great Democrat, and woe is us for losing Yeltsin. Putin is a continuation of, and a kind of grotesque way of Yeltsinism. And under Yeltsin, I remember when I first got out there, I can't remember his last name exactly, but there was a Moskovsky Komsomolets reporter, great reporter, one of their top guys, who was investigating corruption in the defense ministry, and this had to do with the war in Chechnya just as it was starting. And everybody knew that Yeltsin's defense minister arranged this assassination of this journalist, Dmitry Kholodov, I think his name was, where they told him to get this suitcase, a briefcase that had documents that were going to prove another layer of corruption. And he brought it into the Moskovsky Komsomolets office. This is 94, 95, and opened it up, and it blew him up. You know, Galina Starovoitova, who was one of the leading dissidents and a parliament member, and I think a member of Nemtsov's or Chubais's party, was gunned down outside of her apartment. It was 98 or 99. So this is, you know, before Putin came to power, probably by the sort of similar people who would have killed Nemtsov and who would have tried to put a hit on Chubais. It's a violent, brutal, country, and a lot of forces were unleashed, you know, with this radical liberalization program. A lot of very dark, social Darwinistic forces were unleashed and have never really been you know, sort of brought under control, I don't think completely since then. And they've been harnessed instead for different political ends. And I think we're just still dealing with the consequences of that. And, you know, frankly, Boris Nemtsov was part of that problem, which he later turned around and he supported Putin. I mean, you can find his editorial even in the New York Times in 2000. This is after Putin's invasion of Chechnya, where he openly backs Putin and says, you know, the West should back him as well. We forget about how the liberals all lined up behind Putin. So it's a bit of a Frankenstein's monster coming back to bite a lot of these people that originally backed him. And, you know, I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I don't think the answer is, you know, going to war with Russia or, it's just not quite as simple as Putin as some kind of Hitler outlier. He's a part of a process. That's how I see it.
Well, you know, in terms of Monday morning quarterbacking, in terms of the transition, obviously the West was AWOL at that time, and the austerity and shock therapy that came from the West was catastrophic. And the Clinton administration's handling was just anything that Boris Yeltsin wanted, and they were ridiculously afraid of the communists coming back. That was never going to happen. So it's pretty clear that while we were dancing in the end zone, that we won the Cold War, we didn't help in any kind of transition. But on the other hand, I think in retrospect, it's probably unlikely that there could have ever been a liberal establishment stood up to withstand the kind of parasitic combination, the Siloviki, the intelligence people and the criminals, the Vori Vazakoni, that's deep in Russian tradition. And it seems like the organized criminals and the intelligence people were the most organized. And it's quite possible that, you know, Putin saw that all along and made his move. And that's
what I agree. I mean, to blame it all on us is also kind of silly. I mean, we definitely botched it as badly as we possibly could. And we might have been able to have helped steer things in a better way if we had backed other people, or even if we had stuck with by backing Gorbachev, whom we pretty much abandoned a year or two before he was basically passed out. But you know, that said, I mean, Russia has its own very special and unique history, and it's not about to turn into, you know, Mall Land in Omaha, Nebraska, and it's kind of absurd to expect it to. And Putin is he's an incredibly canny, wily politicians, and, you know, profoundly cynical in the way that a lot of powerful people are at that level, and particularly spooks, you know, in Russia, more so than I think a lot of other places. But, you know, the Nemtsov killing for me, it brings up sort of very conflicting emotions. I mean, the protests that are going on now reflect, I think, not Nemtsov's popularity, because he wasn't so popular, as you pointed out in your introduction, but people's fears. It's a very dark and terrifying, you know, image to see of this figure who was once supposed to be Yeltsin's heir. Yeltsin named him at one point as his potential heir apparent back in 97. To see him lying on the street with his shirt pulled up, dead, right next to the Kremlin, it's horrifying. And the truth is that, you know, Putin's popularity is very high, and people back him now in a way probably more so than any time since he's been in power. But it's not necessarily a very positive popularity. It's mixed up with a lot of fear, particularly in the cities and among the bourgeois middle class people. It's a very fearful time, and this is sort of like their worst nightmare.
Well, just in closing, Mark Ames, the liberal bourgeoisie that you mentioned, the professional class, and I imagine a lot of the friends that you made over there in the time that you were there. My understanding is that a lot of them just want to get out, and mm-hmm. that in terms of doing business for the entrepreneurs, it's complete mafia time where they basically come in and say, okay, where the goons come in and say, we're your new partners. So there's no incentive on, you know, to build up any kind of business. You know, like the young guy that started VKontakte, the Russian Facebook, the Kremlin just said, we're your new partners, and he went off into exile. So is that what's happening there, along with the intimidation?
Well, I think definitely the first part of what you said is definitely true, that especially sort of younger professionals and stuff, they are, even and again, even among people who really support Putin or certainly support Russia's position against in the war with Ukraine, are at the same time fearful, wondering if they can get out, would like to get out. I think that's definitely true. That, you know, and about business, I think the sanctions, the drop in oil price, and the sort of the isolation of Russia over the last year is remaking the. You know, there was a certain stability and a certain kind of logic to the corruption in the Russian market, let's say up until a year and a half ago. And that is now definitely changing. And the pie is now shrinking. And there are a lot of wolves out there trying to take different pieces of the pie. And I think that it's kind of a chaotic time. And I don't think people really know exactly what's going to happen next, how business is going to be done next. If Putin's going to start really doing a populist thing, populist politics domestically, and start going after the oligarchs in a big way, I think. I think generally, you know, you're right. Yeah.
Well, Mark, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Ames, who's the founding editor of the satirical Moscow biweekly, The Exile. He's now a senior editor at Pando Daily and the author of Going Postal, Rage, Murder, and Rebellion from Reagan's Workplaces to Clinton's Columbine, and the co-author of The Exile, Sex, Drugs, and Libel in the New Russia. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with an analysis of why gas prices are going up and the failure of the mainstream press to look at the real culprit, the big Wall Street banks.
Dough was horrible. Time is money, spend, waste, save, invest, invest. The 10K cave of chicken chest. S, yes, y'all are double, get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he about to change the price again. They go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, albums shrilling in fear. It won't stop top bill until he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spare. Here, a new meaning to sales through the roof. Guaranteed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tyson Slocum, who is the director of the energy program at Public Citizen, where he works on promoting decentralized, sustainable energy and providing affordable clean energy solutions for working families. He also focuses on incentives away from nuclear, oil, and coal industries towards efficiency, renewable energy, and mass transit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tyson Slocum.
Hey, always great to be here, Ian.
And Tyson, we spoke a little while ago, and you said that the price of gas would come back up again, even though the Saudis are dumping it, and it's basically, frankly, crude is still below $50 a barrel. But you said that the speculators would drive it up, and that is clearly what's happened. But what's extraordinary is that if you watch the news, the television news, they come up with every other excuse under the sun, a fire at a refinery in California, all kinds of excuses, and very rarely anywhere in the media does anybody talk about speculation on Wall Street. And I spoke the other day with Michael Greenberger, the former head of markets at the Commodity Future Trading Commission, and he said it's the five big banks. They're back in the speculating on oil, and they're the ones that are driving the prices up, which they did back in 2008 when oil got up to $147 a barrel. So why is this huge 900-pound gorilla not talked about?
Well, one of the problems is, Ian, is that the mainstream media often assumes that the truth lies somewhere in between what the Democrats say and the Republicans say. What confuses mainstream media is when both leading Democrats and leading Republicans are saying the exact same thing, which is what happens on things like energy prices, where a lot of Wall Street-friendly Democrats coupled with Republicans say, oh, you know, oil prices are only set by supply and demand, and speculation or market manipulation isn't a big factor. And so when you've got a majority of the members of Congress leading with that message that markets are competitive and working, it's a little difficult for those of us with the facts and other progressives like Elizabeth Warren to enter into that fray and say, you know what, there's a lot of other things going on here. Wall Street continues to play an outsized role in influencing the direction of oil prices. The ability of speculators to drive the market beyond the supply-demand fundamentals plays a big role. And that's why we've got to complete the Dodd-Frank regulations that will get rid of these speculators in the market and return us to some level of sanity and fairness in these oil prices.
But isn't there a direct link here that the minute that the Congress changed the rules under lobbying from the five big banks, immediately the price of gas started to go back up again? We had that little bit of a holiday, and the bottom line is that the price of crude is still below $50 a barrel. So the supply hasn't changed. So the supply and demand arguments are complete nonsense. But it seems to me that what's going on here is that the banks buy the congressmen, all the Republicans and a few Democrats vote to give the banks a gift, and then the banks get back into the business and drive the price of oil up. And this is pure parasitic activity. They're just gouging the American consumer every time they go to the pump without any value added. It's just total larceny as far as I can tell.
Right. So what you're referring to is the action by Congress during the lame duck session in December of 2014, where Citigroup, along with some of the other banks, successfully lobbied Congress in a end-of-the-year must-pass appropriations bill that undid a key Dodd-Frank regulatory protection. And remember, Dodd-Frank was the 2010 seminal piece of Wall Street regulatory reform passed in the wake of the financial crisis that returned some much-needed regulatory oversight and accountability over Wall Street. And one of the things that really bothered the banks about the 2010 Dodd-Frank law was this provision that would require them to spin off and disassociate themselves with any affiliates that were engaged in derivatives trading, like oil trade. The banks had seen a very lucrative business in trading energy, particularly oil, and they did not want to have to relinquish those activities. And so this last-minute action by the banks in December of 2014 preserved their ability to continue trading. And it is plausible that this opened the door to the kind of increased level of speculation that we're seeing now. Now, keep in mind, there are supply-demand considerations that do go into pricing oil. What speculation does is amplify those issues and create a whole lot of unneeded volatility where you see very significant price swings, and what you see is the opportunity to move prices up. Because remember, a bank can make more money the more volatile a market is. The more price swings every hour or every day, each of those price swings presents new profit opportunities for banks and their trading operations. If the price of oil remains very constant, it's not moving around, and therefore there aren't a lot of profit-making opportunities. So the banks require a volatile market, and they enter the market creating volatility and therefore creating more opportunity. And, of course, what's good for the banks here is terrible for consumers. And that's why we're seeing more pain at the pump. And, you know, we all want to get off of oil in our economy. But right now, we're dependent upon oil. Working families don't have a lot of access to alternative clean solutions. And I just don't want to see the banks punish people who don't have a lot of other good options.
And again, I'm speaking with Tyson Slocum, who's the director of the energy program at Public Citizen. He works on promoting decentralized, sustainable energy and providing affordable, clean energy solutions for working families, and promotes refocusing incentives away from nuclear, oil, and coal industries towards efficiency, renewable energy, and mass transit. So the whole point of having the commodities futures trading is that the end users are supposed to be able to hedge against bad weather and other factors that might affect the price of whatever commodity they're trading, whether it's wheat, soybeans, or oil. And there have been efforts to try and limit the participants in those markets. In other words, Pillsbury has a reason to be in trading grain, and American Airlines has an interest in the price of gas, so they have legitimate reasons to want to hedge. But the idea that these big banks are just have a little private casino going at the expense of the American consumer, it just seems absolutely indefensible. And again, I'm astounded that the mainstream press does not make that link to let the public know that they're being gouged. And they, you know, the price of gas has gone up almost 50 cents in a week here in California, and it's all being attributed to a fire at a refinery. And you just feel like there's this orchestrated lying going on.
Well, yeah, you know, about 15 years ago, 85% of the trading volume in crude oil futures was by end users and producers who, like you said, were in commodity markets for the sole purpose of hedging their exposure to risk. So 15 years ago, 85% of the trading volume was producers and consumers. Today, 85% of the trading volume is by speculators, and only 15% are the producers and the consumers. And so these markets have been turned on their head. They have now been designed to accommodate the interests of the speculators to the detriment of those end users, like you said, airlines, UPS, industrials, American consumers, and some oil producers. And so this is the problem that we see, and the economy is not well served by having a speculative-driven economic system. We're getting away from the fundamentals, and as we've learned very painfully, what's good for Citi and Goldman Sachs is not necessarily good for America.
So is there a list, Tyson, of those people who voted for this rule change in the must-pass spending bill at the end of last year? And I'm particularly interested in a list of the Democrats who voted, gave this gift to the five big Wall Street banks so that they could get back into speculating on oil, which they're clearly doing now, and gouging.
There is a roll call vote. You know, we had heroes like Elizabeth Warren, senator from Massachusetts, vote against it. One of the problems was that the vote occurred in December of 2014. That's during a period what's known as the lame duck session. So you have an election in November, and a bunch of senators lost their seats, a bunch of new senators are coming in, but that change doesn't occur until January. So that period between the November 2014 election and January 2015, when the new members come in and the old members leave, that's the lame duck session. And so historically, that's been a problematic time period because you've got members of Congress who are no longer really directly accountable casting key votes. And that's what we saw in this December 2014 appropriations vote. You saw a number of senators who were voted out of office play an important role in giving this giveaway to the banks.
But why would they do that? Is that some kind of golden parachute they're getting in their retirement? Are they going to go work on Wall Street? Why sell out the American people when you, because normally in government service, when you finally get out of government, or particularly if you're in, say, the intelligence world, you know, you finally can become a truth teller. But the opposite seems to be happening here.
I'm not sure what the reasons are. It's plausible given the corrupting influence of the revolving door, the lucrative nature of post-congressional career working as a lobbyist. Let me tell you something. Former senators aren't working for us at Public Citizen, right? We can't afford them. They go to work as high-priced lobbyists where they trade on their name and their Rolodexes to do favors for whoever's willing to pay them the most money. And as we know, the banks have an awful lot of money to pay these former members of Congress. So, you know, you have to believe that corrupting influence of the revolving door plays a role in influencing these votes.
So they basically watered down Dodd-Frank, and they removed the authority of the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's oversight. Is there any way to bring it back? I mean, you know, this is, again, I fault the press here for not making the connection between the five big banks speculating on oil and the fact that everybody's being gouged at the pump now, and the press is dutifully reporting all kinds of extraneous reasons, you know, like a refinery fire, et cetera, and not explaining the direct link here. So obviously it would be helpful if some decent reporting was done on this. Then the public might get a little bit riled up and light a fire under these senators and congressmen who are working not for the American people but for the big banks on Wall Street.
Well, Ian, that's why community-supported radio is so critical to keep the public informed about this, because too often the for-profit media fails at its job to adequately report these important issues.
Well, I do recall back when oil got to $147 a barrel back in 2008 that 60 Minutes did do a program on it, and they made an absolutely clear, ironclad case that it again was the big banks on Wall Street that were running the price of oil up, and that there were, you know, oil contracts that J.P. Morgan Chase had where they were essentially, you know, filling up tankers and having them steam around in circles.
Right. So we've got documented evidence. We've got a number of reports out from different academics. We've got data from the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission that all point to the extensive role that speculators have in dominating these markets. And again, you know, 100% of the price of oil is not set by speculators. There is underlying supply and demand that plays a role. But what the speculators do by driving almost all of the activity in the market is they are amplifying in very painful ways the supply and demand fundamentals in ways to skew the markets and to skew prices. And that's really what we're seeing today in these markets.
But, again, we have to remind the audience, Tyson Slocum, that crude oil is still below $50 a barrel. It's at $49 a barrel. So talk about market fundamentals.
Right. What you see is a number of opportunities to skew the gasoline markets. And, again, there are some other issues in the physical gasoline markets. We are exporting record amounts of motor gasoline. We are now exporting over 3 million barrels of refined petroleum like gasoline and diesel every single day. 75% of those exports are coming out of the Gulf Coast. So,
by the way, Tyson, isn't that why they want the Keystone? Because they're going to be exporting refined products from the Gulf.
Of course. This is the Keystone Pipeline has absolutely nothing to do with strengthening American energy security or lowering gas prices. In fact, it would increase gasoline prices because it's all about moving landlocked Canadian crude oil, moving it down through the middle of the United States to the Gulf Coast where it can be exported for higher prices outside of North America. So that's playing a role. And then you've got the ability of traders to amplify those problems and push prices even higher.
Well, Tyson Slocum, I thank you for joining us here today and for discussing this very important issue. I know you've brought it up recently when I talked to you, and I wanted to do a follow-up because I think this is the big 900-pound gorilla that nobody wants to talk about.
Absolutely, and thanks again for the opportunity to come on and discuss it.
And again, I've been speaking with Tyson Slocum, who's the director of the energy program at Public Citizen. He works on promoting decentralized, sustainable energy and providing affordable, clean energy solutions for working families and getting rid of incentives such as oil, nuclear and coal industry incentives and replacing them with more efficiency, renewable energy and mass transit. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.